Welcome to The Author's Tale, brought to you by Edition Audiobooks. I'm Stephanie Fruin, and this is part three of fantasy writer Helen Lowe's tale. We ended part two discussing her first book, Thornspell, and in part one we looked at some of Helen's poetry. If you haven't listened to both, I highly recommend you do. A reminder that this conversation was recorded in a meeting room at a public library during a very large storm. So yes, you will hear people moving around and talking, along with the wind and rain against the windows. You will also hear an odd rubbing sound, which is coming from a leather jacket. It's too chilly to remove it. In this part of our discussion, we talk about her first book, Ear of Night, which is also the first in her Wall of Night series, and we also talk about the final book of the series, yet to be published. We discuss the importance of names, character and place names, and how wrong or right they can be. I reveal my complete ignorance of fantasy writing and where you'll find information to help the reader understand the worlds you're about to step into. And Helen provides all sorts of hints and tips for the up-and-coming writer within this amazing genre. It really is completely different to any other and has a rule book all of its own.
About riding horses and weapons, yes, and hunting, yes, and things. But he can read.
He's just busy doing other things.
And he's busy doing other things, and he'd much rather be outside, you know, galloping around and doing things. And so I did sort of smile, but I kind of thought, that's all about who the character is. And I would have to write a very different story to have a bookish hero.
Yes, you would. You would. Oh, my goodness me. There was something else that entered my head about that, but I can't remember what it was. So now let's talk about the Ear of Night. So this one, of course, you had actually written before Thornspell, as we now know. How long after Thornspell was it published?
2010 in US and 2011 in UK.
Yeah, and of course you already had it ready to go.
Yes, it hasn't really helped me with the later books, unfortunately. It's a very big story.
It is a huge story, and what I love, of course, and you can see on the very front cover, we have a female, you know, lead character, for want of a better description, who is very strong right from the outset, a very strong girl in this. Yeah, so tell us a wee bit about the Ear of Night. Quite different, the same, but different to Thornspell.
Well, the way I think of them is, Thornspell is a novel set in this world, the myths and magic and everything, but also the history of this world. So it's like a kingdom not quite too far away, the kingdom next door type thing, but it's still mythical kingdom.
Yeah.
The Ear of Night is much more like Lord of the Rings. It's a completely alternate world with its own mythologies and cultures and histories and everything.
Yes.
So you're immediately in a different ball game. And I think the other thing is that I always think that although it has its darker moments, Thornspell is a book from the springtime of the world. It has that sort of kind of lightness and brightness to a lot of the world.
Yes.
And, you know, there's some fun in there's fun in these books as well, but, you know, the relationships between the boys, as one reviewer said, all those ridiculous young men. And I thought they are a little bit ridiculous at times, but some of them, their hearts are in the right place, you know. So it's, so that's kind of a springtime of the world book. And this is like Tolkien in one of his final epilogue or whatever it is to the Lord of the Rings, the story of Arwen and Aragorn.
Yeah, yeah.
He talks about the darkness in winter that comes without a star.
Yeah.
And that to me is the Wall of Night series. It's adult, although I think it crosses over as well between younger, I think, you know, teens, mid-teens and even...
Yeah.
You know, avid readers who are younger will be fine with the book.
Yeah.
But it's themes I think are adult.
So The Ear of Night, so it also got great reviews.
Yeah.
As well. And I'm assuming it sold well.
Yep.
Yeah. Also, in which countries really sort of picked it up?
It's been published in the US and UK and markets, which means there's other countries, USA, Canada, and some other countries that are under that mark. And then the UK is UK and Commonwealth.
Yeah.
So it comes from the UK into Australia and New Zealand,
yeah.
But also into India and those countries, and English countries, where English is like a major language. Mm. And it's also been translated into Dutch, German and French.
Fabulous.
Mm. Which is actually quite modest for translations compared to something like Harry Potter, but which I think is in every language under the sun.
Yes, but even though Harry Potter was in a different world, I suppose, I mean, I guess I've already said it a gazillion times, but it's the work that it takes to create those worlds that you've created. Mm. And since you've also said that you made up all of the names for this book as well, there was one that really did my head in.
Well, Yoren de Zarenin.
Thank you. Yes.
You know,
I'm going, Yoren de Zarenin.
Well,
Yoren de Zarenin. Yeah. How do I say it? You know, and then in my head I'm giving it an accent. Does it help if I'm Irish?
To tell you what, Yoren de Zarenin's name is a tribute to the fantasies I loved when I was a kid and young adult, where really long names. So there's a book by Patricia McKillop, and it's not the main character. It's called The Riddle Master of Head, and in it there's a wizard called If, of the unpronounceable name, because his name is so long that's why everyone just calls him If. That's the first syllable.
Fabulous.
It's so fabulous.
The Riddle Master of Head is a fantasy novel written by Patricia McKillop and was published in 1976. It is the first book of her Riddle Master trilogy, and it takes place in a world where all wisdom is presented as riddles to be solved. The Riddle Master series remains McKillop's most popular body of works.
How fabulous!
It's so fabulous. And so I was determined to have like a tribute to my love of really long names in there, but I'd got a little wiser, and so I knew that they couldn't be the names of my main characters. And even in the book, I have characters, the knight characters, casting aspersions about the long stars. They're so up themselves. They always have these long, ridiculous names. Yes. And so it's sort of a little in-joke, I guess. But then I explain, and this is where the myth thing, come back to my myth and history, is that in the third book, it's explained that the more powerful you are in the House of Stars, the longer your name will be.
Oh, my Lord.
Because the syllables of the name are related to power. And that is, so in the Old Testament, the name of God, you couldn't speak it, because even the true name of God was sort of sacred and hidden, because even the syllables of his name were power. And in a lot of traditional societies, your true name, or you know, like there's this idea that your true name or your true identity, you've got to protect it. So you know, you have nicknames and things. So you know, so it's sort of like it's kind of but anyway, yes,
what I love about this as well, about the Heir of Night, at the very beginning of the book. And of course, so even Malian or Malian, depending on where we are in the world.
Malian.
See, isn't that just crazy? I'm going Malian, Malian.
Well, any is okay. But to me, it's Malian.
Malian.
Mal as in black.
Yes.
Ah. You know, it's the Mal as in black. She's from the House of Night. So Mal Herers. So it's Mal as in Malamur. Maldumur, sorry,
fabulous.
You know, Malaise.
Fabulous. Mm. Oh, instantly I thought it was very Shakespearean. The girl touched the battered figure with her fingertips and pulled back the fabric. The hero, Yoren de Zarenin, she whispered, and the worm of chaos. The old keep caught the voice and tossed into shadowy corners, bouncing echoes off stone and shutting while the wind whispered all around. Also just thinking about, like, so for me, when you think about when Shakespeare was writing, of course he was very influenced by astronomy. Mm. You know, all these things that you have brought into your writing. Mm. Now, why have I got this bit here? The dreams of them, and this, we've talked about dreams,
yeah.
And of course, in here, the dreams are so important yet again. And I think that's something that
actually I had a compliment from one of my readers, who's a retired psychologist, because he asked me if I'd studied Jung, and I had to, because Jung wrote a lot about dreams and I had to say no, I hadn't just came all from the kind of, but he thought it was very the way I did the dreams was very credible from a psychological point of view.
Definitely. And I think this thing, because we all dream, some people claim they can't remember their dreams, but I think we can all kind of relate to the dreams that, you know, that you go off to some weird and wonderful places, you meet some bizarre creatures and you think, what was that about?
And it's all jumbled, the way it's jumbled and sort of chaotic.
You leap from place to place, and it's really bizarre. So we can understand all of that, you know, we get that in your writing. So I have read this one and the one afterwards, The Gathering of the Lost. Which is book two.
And I was going to say about things, people seeing things in your book that you don't necessarily pick up on yourself.
Yeah.
My editor, Kate Nansel, in the US, she's the lead editor for the series. When she loved the book, when I submitted the manuscript, and she said, and she'd read it, and she said to me, this is so much a book about friendship and the obligations we owe to each other, you know, like there's family, society, but the relationships of friendships and the strength, you know, self and other. And, you know, and I'm going, you know, I didn't sit down. As soon as she said it, I could see she was absolutely right.
Yes.
But I didn't consciously sit down to write that book. And I think that's kind of what Kate de Goldie means when she says every writer has a bone that they gnaw on. So there are things that are sort of percolating away for the writer that will come out in the writing, but they're not necessarily that you sit down and think, well, I want to write a book about friendship.
And if you did, it would probably be really dull.
Yeah, possibly.
Because that would take over from the imagination and from the character want and needs, because I'm guessing that what happens, well, maybe not, but you know, you have an idea of maybe where the story's going, but then the character will say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm actually going to go and do this. You know, the character takes on their own life, don't they?
Yeah.
So The Era of the Night. So can you, because you've done, the fourth book hasn't been published yet, has it?
No, I'm just finishing it.
I was thinking, surely it must be nearly done.
Yes, I know. Yeah. It's been a very long time.
Yeah, but you know, your third book is about 700 odd pages.
It's huge.
It's enormous. Oh, can I also say that, you know, this is what I'm like. So I pick up a book and I read it, I go from the beginning, I read, or, you know, do the whole shebang, and then I'm struggled my way through the names and the places, try my hardest to try and work out who's who.
And then you found the glossary.
at the back of the book. So if anyone who is going to pick this book up and read it, look at the back, because there's a wonderful glossary.
Yeah, it tells you who everyone is, so you can just dip into it and remind yourself.
Honestly, I don't know what my face said when I got there, but it was... really?
Yeah.
Oh, if only I'd flicked at the back, you know. Because, you know, sometimes it is really tempting to do that with a book. You go, I'll go to the back and just, you know, just do whatever.
Well, I must admit, as a fantasy reader, I always know to check the back, because there's often maps, more maps. Sometimes there's more maps.
I was hoping there would be
a map.
Oh, there was one here.
There's a map at the front.
Yes.
But sometimes there'll be bonus maps, but there's often glossaries and compendiums of this and that. And
see, now I know.
Appendices, and so it's kind of like, it's part of the genre, the map, glossary.
A bit of knowledge, isn't it?
It's sort of all part of, I'm afraid it is all Tolkien's fault, because he had these amazingly detailed maps. He had... like, what was it, 10 or 12 or 15 appendices?
Yeah.
And which I have to tell you, as a fan, at age 14, I read every
single
word.
One. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Fabulous. So when the TV show came out last year, The Second Age, Lord of the Rings, Second Age, or whatever it was called.
Being honest.
I have watched it. Yeah. And there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of things like, it's not correct to the real Tolkien. But the thing that I, because I've read every word of those appendices and the Silmarillion, which was a bit of a slog, because it's really more like Tolkien's notes and his own personal history. It's not a novel like Lord of the Rings. Yeah. But anyway, I read it all. So I know that a lot of the stuff in that was actually quite, if you've read that stuff, you know it is actually true to the vision, that Galadriel, for example, although she was an elder stateswoman by the time you, and had mallowed enormously by the time you, thousands of years later, by the time you get to the Lord of the Rings, when she was young, she was very hawkish. So, you know, so they picked up on, because it is thousands of years before, they kind of picked up on that element of her character. So,
interesting. Well, see, now I know. So I've learnt that now. So now I look at the back, look at those maps, and then you don't have to write your own or draw your own map.
Unfortunately, there's only one map. But, I thought that I might do, maybe I'll do some more when I've finished, because I could... But they're a lot of work.
Are you an artist?
No. A friend of mine is the artist.
Who?
Peter Fitzpatrick, his name is.
Based in New Zealand?
Based in here in Christchurch.
Wow.
Close friend. We used to do Aikido together many years ago.
Now, I want to ask you about your martial arts and your fencing that, you've done. Because I'm reading, because I have a niece who's a black belt in karate. And my own son did it as well. And the fencing, he gave that, you know, we sort of tried that for a bit. But I love it. I think it's fabulous. And having trained, being in theatre, we trained in, you know, in
stage fighting.
Stage fighting and fencing. We had a bit of all that as well. And there's a real art to it. And I love in all of your books that I've read, you give great detail about the fencing and the stance as well. And surely your own training and your background, that helped hugely.
Hugely. And I still have various swords, my Japanese Boken from Aikido and, you know, the rapier. And when things are happening, I'll go, if he's striking like this.
You pick it up and you do it.
I'll do it. Yeah. I'll pick it up and I'll do it. And I'll kind of...
Act it out.
Act it out. Yeah. Just to make sure that that it's not impossible.
Yeah,
you know, like it's maybe fantasy and it may be magic and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
but I like to sort of keep it as grounded in realism as possible.
And you can totally see that in your books, I think, because it just rings true. Totally rings true. All of that action. Yeah.
We're going to pause our chat briefly for us to listen to a very small snippet of Air of Night. In this piece, our heroine, Malian, is battling her way to safety, encountering all sorts of otherworldly forces as she does so. Her body begins to shake with the effort of holding the dark regard at bay. The power that buffeted her was immense, snatching away both her breath and her grip on the tree. She fell, tumbling through twigs and leaves, and only just managed to catch at her strength and training in the last moments, landing in a crouch. Power gusted again, and a jagged line ran through the wall that separated her from the house used by the Dark Sworn. The next moment, the wall came tumbling down in a thunder of bricks and clouds of mortar dust. It was the touch of the horn that had done it. Malian knew that without needing to be told. She could see the portal was closing too, but not before more warriors in blue-black armour swarmed through behind Nindoroth, silver-white lightning bolts striking down on either side of their closed helms. The arriving demon had grown formless again, but she could feel his will grasping for control of her mind. Grimly, Malian threw him off and felt Nindoroth's ripple of surprise. "Who are you? What?" The voice of power cracked around her, crashing into her head like storm waves so that she almost fell again. She gritted her teeth, forcing herself to stay upright. Her hand and mind moved instinctively toward the sustaining cold of the hero's arm ring, because right now all that mattered was escape, and Nenea had gone completely silent, inert as any base metal. Hiding, she realised, recalling how Nindoroth had looked through illusion and shadow and seen her. Malian's lips moved, mouthing an incantation that thickened the cloud of mortar dust as she slipped sideways into the elm's shadow. The lightning warriors were spreading out across the wall's fallen bricks as Nindorath grasped for her mind again. The shutters along the terrace had been pushed back and someone inside the house was yelling. Malian caught the words, "Intruders!" and "Enemy attack!" as she flung off Nindorath a second time, but knew she could not fend him off for long. A bowstring thrummed from the terrace as Malian dived into what was left of the shrubbery beside the fallen wall and wormed her way through it like a snake. The dark mind darted after her, quick as a serpent itself, and the warriors shouted, running to close off physical escape. Malian knew Nindorath would direct them straight to her unless she could conceal both mind and body. But the garden was too small. Wherever she hid, they would hunt her out soon. She hesitated, the scent of earth and rotting leaves strong in her nostrils. The green power that had stirred in Maravale Wood welled through her as she breathed in, intensely aware of the elm's deep roots and the shallower fibres of the shrubbery, as well as the numerous insects and minute night creatures that inhabited the small world. A beetle crawled out of leaf mulch and over her hand as another tendril of dark power slithered across her mind. This time Malian did not throw it off, but instead let her energy dissipate amongst the myriad small lives of the night garden. A man's voice cursed very close to her, and across the street a shutter banged open, a querulous voice demanding to know what was going on. Malian's lips moved again, not gathering illusion and shadow this time, the stock and trade of the shadow band, but drawing the tiny pulse beats and formless thoughts around her into a loose weave before tapping deeper still into the memory of the trees in Maravale Wood, shifting to banish apparitions. The elm creaked, although the night breeze had died away, and Malian cast her net of small energies and diffuse minds outward, spreading to catch the swarm hunter. The elm creaked again, dangerously, its great trunk bending and its branches whipping to the ground. The warriors cried out, jumping back, and Malian felt her patchwork net close over Nindorath's power. She sensed the dark mind recoil, then immediately recover, flowing along the cobwebbed weave to find its source. But she was already springing for the outer wall, pulling a flurry of shadows along with her to confuse the hunters. Behind her, the net disintegrated, and Malian bit her lip, hoping the weave had been loose enough for the small night creatures to flee through the gaps. But she was over the wall now and away, sprinting past the nearest alley and down a side street. Her eyes raked its length for a quick route to the rooftop as Nindorath's minesweep blasted. Malian staggered, knowing it would have wiped her mind clear had she not been steeled for it. Fighting nausea, she ran on as a gate thudded open behind her and boots pounded on cobbles. Malian's temples pounded too, sensing a second minesweep building. A psychic shield slammed around her like rock, shutting the minesweep out. "Here!" Malian caught a mental image through the mind call of a coal hatch at the alley's far end, offering an easy climb to the top of the wall and then the roof. Behind her, the pursuing voices had grown confused, and she guessed they would now be checking every alley and peering through gates into shadowed gardens. Springing onto the hatch, Malian leapt for the arms that came down and grasped hers, hauling her body to the roof. "Let's go," said Cullen, as he and Tarathan released her arms. Malian nodded, sucking in a great lungful of air, then racing after them along the roof. She could still feel Nindorath's power, shockingly strong on the far side of the shield's buffer. A quick glance back showed the rooftop still empty as they ducked around the gable end of the next house. They ran along the eaves and up the adjoining roof towards a cluster of chimneys, dropping into the deep shadow at their base and slithering to the far side of the brick stacks. All around them, Caer Argent stretched away, a sea of tiles interspersed by slender spires with the Basilica of Amun, a great island in the distance. Another mind sweep shook the night, but passed harmlessly away as Callan swung the crossbow off his back. The sword at his side was short, with a long dagger on the opposite side and the haft of another just showing above his boot. He was wearing an archer's leather cap and quilted gambeson to avoid the betraying rattle of metal, Malian guessed. On his far side, Tarathan still wore his herald's grey, but carried a short, recurved bow and had the swallowtail swords strapped to his back. "How did you know where I was?" she asked, keeping her voice very low, but avoiding the betraying hiss of a whisper. Callan shrugged.
because of our bond. I knew you were there when we left the palace yard, but once in the square, I realised that you were tracking someone else. He glanced sideways at the herald. Tarathan knew you were close too. I was able to follow you at a distance, Tarathan said, until Callan joined me and could shield us both. Nine cursed, Darkspawn is strong. Callan sounded almost breathless, as though he was running again. Another mind sweep blasted across the night. My shield may not hold, not against this. We need to lose them, Malian agreed. Her mind raced, weighing options and odds. Callan grunted. I vote for opening a portal and disappearing. No! Nenea was incisive. Nindoroth will sense the gate opening, and tracking through the Gate of Dreams is one of his specialities. Wonderful, thought Malian. She detected a patch of darkness, then several more drifting up towards the rooftops. No time now, she said conversationally. We've got company.
And realism yeah, as possible.
And you can totally see that in your books, I think, because it just rings true. Totally rings true, all of that action. Yeah. And you've got your fourth book about you to come out.
Well, wow. I'm about to finish it. It will be sometime after that it comes out.
Yes. Yeah. So we've got The Heir of Night, The Gathering of the Lost, The Daughter of Blood. Yep. Is the third one. That's the real chunky one, the 700-odd pages worth. Mm. And then your fourth and final, is it going to be the final book of the series?
It is the final. I'm writing the final, the grand.
Note that, everybody.
The boss fight. The boss fight, the big bad.
Yes.
Malian and the big bad. Yes. Malian and sidekicks. There are a lot of sidekicks.
Yeah.
So I was actually doing a little chart this morning because the main thread is Malian's.
Yeah.
But there's 1, 2, 3, 4. 4.5 or 5 threads of things going on simultaneously in this sort of final showdown.
Yeah. Are you a...
You have been listening to part 3 of season 2 of The Author's Tale, featuring Helen Lowe, presented and produced by me, Stephanie Fruin. I hope you're enjoying Helen's tale. Don't forget to follow to get instant notifications of future episodes, including part 4 of Helen's story. You can find out more about Helen on her website, www.helenlowe.info. The link is in the show notes. Thank you for listening to The Author's Tale, brought to you by Edition Audiobooks and Digital Publishing, helping you bring your books to life. EditionAudiobooks.com.